thanks to everyone for coming. We really appreciate your coming out and being interested in the work that we do. I'm Ellie. I'm one of GiveWell's co-founders. This is Holden. He's the other co-founder. That's Alexander Berger. He's an analyst at GiveWell. And then there's just a few GiveWell board members who are here that I just want to quickly point out. There's Bridget, Tom, Phil, and Tim. So those are the GiveWell folks who are here right now. The way that this is going to go is there's going to be about an hour of programming where our goal is to, in a few very brief stints, lay out the topics that we can talk about. And then we're hoping to turn it over to all of you for open Q&A about GiveWell, what we do, how we do it, any questions you have, things you think we're doing wrong that we could do better. You know, this is really an opportunity for us to openly discuss what's happening at GiveWell. You know, we know that we put a lot of information out on our website, but it's not always easy for someone to engage productively with it. And so we really hope these meetings, which we hold a few times a year, are a way to do that. One quick note, consistent with our general approach, which aims to share as much as we can about the work that we do. We're recording this meeting. We're planning to post a recording of it, a transcript of it online. There's also a couple guys here from NPR with a recorder. We and they are happy to cut anything from the recording. If you want to say something but don't want it to be on the record, just say like, hey, I'd rather this not go into the recording either before you say it or after you say it. But please do let us know so we can exclude that from the posted materials. So, GiveWell's main goals right now are threefold. You know, one is we're continuing the work that we've been doing for a long time to find proven, cost-effective global health organizations. I can talk a lot about the work that we've done there this year and what we're planning to do for the future, but I want to put that out as one of the main things that we're working on right now for people to feel free to ask about. The second big goal for this year is recruiting. You know, GiveWell is still a very small staff. Mm-hmm. We're currently 7 people. We're trying to scale up to be more. And so a big goal of ours in 2013 is finding the people who can help us do more of the type of research that we're trying to do. And then the final big area that I think we'll end up covering the bulk of discussion tonight is going to be some of the newer areas that we're looking into, newer areas of philanthropy outside of the proven cost-effective global health stuff. Those are things that Holden and Alexander are going to talk about in a little bit. There is this big shift going on at GiveWell where for a long time we focused on proven cost-effective health charities, and now we're looking at these other areas. And I think the question we've gotten a lot is, you know, why is this happening? GiveWell's done something that's really great. Why move into these other areas? And there's a couple of reasons we're doing this. One of the major reasons is we just think that these other areas might provide really great giving opportunities for donors that beat, so to speak, in, let's say, dollars per impact relative to what our top charities right now can offer, what the Against Malaria Foundation or GiveDirectly or SCI can do. And our mission is to find the best giving opportunities, and so we want to make sure to look into them. The other reason that we're looking into them is that, you know, we frankly feel like we're reaching the point of diminishing returns on the investigation of these global health organizations. One of the big reasons is when we started, we had never looked into these things at all. And now we spent 5-6 years looking for the exact same type of organization. And our bet now is that a bigger reason that we're not finding them is not that we haven't spent the time to reach out to all of them, but that, you know, they just don't exist. So we're obviously maintaining this focus. We are continuing to do updates on our top organizations. We're reaching out to the organizations that we think are the most likely top contenders, and we're making it very clear that anyone who thinks they have the type of evidence that could put them in the top tier should let us know, but we're not actively searching in the way that we have in the past for new organizations. I just want to give one quick example of something we worked on recently in this area of global health organizations. We got pretty interested in the cause of clean water or water purification because we came into contact with a couple of organizations that seemed pretty promising in the way that they were doing things. They were transparent, they were open. One organization is called Dispensers for Safe Water. They're affiliated with Innovations for Poverty Action, or IPA, that runs the randomized controlled trials out of Yale. And so this organization grew out of a trial that they had done. And then there's another organization called Splash that does water filtration systems. And so we looked into this cause of whether and to what extent clean water is effective. And the way that purifying water is supposed to work is you know, the water has contaminants in it, you clean the water, and that prevents children from getting diarrhea. Diarrhea is, for us, is a little bit of a problem, but in the developing world, it's one of the leading causes of death. And when you look at the evidence, it's much less clear than, you know, I would have thought it was when we first came to look at this issue. There's been a lot of randomized controlled trials of clean water, and collectively they do find this impact on reducing diarrhea, but many of the studies have a very particular methodological flaw. The diarrhea rates are self-reported, and the studies themselves are not blinded. And what this means is that the people who are in the study and the researchers know who's part of the treatment group, meaning who got the cleaner water, and who's part of the control group, who didn't. And so people may be inclined to give the answer that they're expected to give as opposed to the answer about what really happened. And in fact, this is to some extent borne out by the evidence. The three papers that we found that had the most methodologically rigorous approach and didn't have this flaw, they didn't find a significant effect on diarrhea rates. Now, that's not to say that, you know, there's issues with those studies as well, so it's not really to say that we know that those programs don't work. But when you compare something like clean water to something like bed nets, well, in bed nets, you have tens of trials that show that nets reduce malaria, that nets reduce deaths. In the case of clean water, we have very, very limited evidence, if any evidence at all, that it really works to have the impact that you think. And so that's the type of approach that we generally take, that we've taken in one case this year, to investigate new organizations. And these are ones that, you know, at this point, though we're still working on the research, it's not published yet, it's the type of approach that doesn't seem promising enough to be warranted getting a spot on the top list. So with that, I guess I just want to pause and want to open it up for questions about anything I've said about our past top charities, our current plans for more charities, or anything else. And then after questions, we can move on to the other areas of our research. Yep.
You said the problem with the clean water studies was that they weren't blind, but with the bed net studies, it's impossible to make them blind. So if you want to compare apples to apples,
yeah, so I mean, so I'm going to repeat the questions people asked for the sake of the recording. So the question is, you know, are the bed nets, I mentioned the study of blinding the water studies. What about the bed net studies? I mean, one difference is that there are multiple bed net studies that look at deaths, right? And so deaths is an objective measure that's not self-reported data, where the blinding factor doesn't come into account.
There's also, I mean, another common measure in malaria studies is sort of cases of malaria, but that's, it can be measured different ways. It can be self-reported, but it can also be reported by the hospitals and by the health system. So there's big, yeah, it's not blinded, but there's big differences in how worried you should be about blinding with those outcomes.
And then the third thing is that some of the Bennett trials actually randomly allocate the insecticide to whether or not it's on the net. And so some people actually do use nets, and they're just not insecticide treated, and that finds actually surprisingly comparable effects to the studies that just don't use a net at all. Most of the effect, we think, is from the
insecticide.
I don't think any of those are actually like blinded, like fake insecticide, although I could be wrong.
No, yeah. They just don't have insecticide. Yeah. It's a net.
Tim?
So one of the critiques of GiveWell from the academic community is sort of the overly practical lack of theory sort of thing that drives us, and it occurs to me this happens in the diarrhea thing. So the known sort of channel for diarrhea is a waterborne pathogen. So what's that? I mean, how do you integrate that if the water is clean and there is no waterborne, where is the diarrhea coming from?
So Tim's question is there's some understanding that there's a mechanism through which pathogens cause diarrhea. If you take out the pathogens, you should prevent the diarrhea. I had a conversation a couple years ago with a water expert. Unfortunately, when we tried to get the notes published, as we tend to do with these calls, we weren't able to. But one of the things that he said is that, and this is where like the we just don't know enough about the theory to really know, is that there's a certain intensity or volume of pathogen required to cause diarrhea. And so therefore, the leading explanation that he thinks is what's causing diarrhea is an amount of fecal material on people's hands. And therefore, hand washing studies, quantity of water is very effective because it washes off the stuff on people's hands that causes the problem, where the clean water itself is not what's doing it. That said, like our basic next steps with this, I mean, this is kind of like research as it's happening. You know, we're going to finish this page and send it to the people who we think are most likely to have criticisms of it and push back, you know, in addition, obviously, to publishing the page once it's done. And so we'll, you know, get as much of this as we can.
And on the kind of broader critique about being atheoretical, I mean, I think there's a couple things you could mean by that. So we don't engage in formal, you know, mathematical theory building the way that some branches of economics do. On the other hand, I think, you know, our attention to kind of the story of how something is supposed to work is a lot higher than you might see from some of the, you know, what might be called randomistas. And that does underlie a lot of our conclusions that aren't the same as theirs. And this water versus bed nets thing is a good example, right? It's not like we're checking boxes, you know, is it blinded, is it this, is it that. It's the combination in the water case, the combination of the lack of blinding, the self-reported outcomes that don't really have a good check on them, the fact that the trials that had the good blinding didn't have the same outcomes, and the fact that we've talked to experts and we see another explanation of what could be going on. That's what makes us really leery of the whole thing. We generally are putting together many pieces like that for any conclusion that we're going to bet on.
Ella, you mentioned a page. Can you talk about what that page is and what we can expect to see on it?
Yeah. So if anyone is really interested in seeing a draft version of the page, I'm happy to send it to you. It's like pretty close to done. I mean, it's similar to what we call these intervention reports that we've done for many programs in the past, where what we do is look at the evidence. So we look at the Cochrane Collaboration, which does high-quality literature reviews of evidence. We then go out and try to find evidence ourselves. We look at all the trials we can find that seem potentially relevant and just write up what we think and why.
So if I know someone who's really excited about water charities, is this a resource I could direct that person to?
So this is a general, I mean, you definitely can, though it's a general issue with, you know, our main priority now, and it has been for a long time, is doing research and then being transparent about what we find, rather than making it particularly accessible to the average donor, let's say. And so in many, you know, you should take a look at the page and see whether you think it's something that the person you know would find helpful. But the other fact is there's a lot of different types of water charities out there. You know, there's the ones that dig wells, and there's the ones that do the clean water. And this is specifically focused on the water purification approach, like putting a chlorine tablet in the water or a filtration system rather than trying to dig wells.
And just for a little perspective, I mean, this water thing is something that we have done this year. It's an example of the kind of work we're doing on traditional GiveWell to the extent we're doing it. But it's not, you know, this isn't the main thing that's going on at GiveWell right now, and it's probably good to keep that in mind.
Yep.
That's it. One more question. What's IPA's perspective on that? I mean, I read a little bit about that. I mean, I guess they had measured sort of the use of chlorine, putting the tablets by the well made it more effective. But I mean, you know, you said this chart is actually coming out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the question is what, you know, this charity came out of research done by Innovations for Poverty Action. What's their take? So I actually had a chance to visit this organization when I was in Kenya last fall visiting Give Directly. You know, they had a much more positive view on the effects of chlorine than we did. And one of the first people that we're going to like send this page to once it's completed the GiveWell process is them and say, like, do you disagree? You know, that said, I think that, you know, my guess is that their real focus is on the program and its impact. There's no question that, the randomized control trial they ran increases chlorination use. And so if you take as an assumption that chlorine works, then this is a great program. And, you know, it would not be unreasonable to rely on the view of the Cochrane Collaborations report, which is a generally positive one about the impacts of chlorination. But anyway, we will ask and we'll get the answer to that.
Okay, so I am going to talk about some of the stuff we're doing on GiveWell Labs, and basically, you know, what I'm personally focused on. There's a few different things we're doing to explore other causes. So Alexander will talk about kind of the efforts he's been leading, that where we have a long list of causes and we're trying to investigate them at kind of a shallow level of detail and some at a deeper level of detail. I'm doing something different, which I'm basically trying to understand the two areas of philanthropy that I would say we know the least about right now. So I would say that, you know, when you look at what foundations do and what they've historically done well, and this is something we've written about, most of it falls into three categories. There's kind of direct aid, which is, you know, for example, paying for the delivery of interventions to the very poor. And then there's two other things that are very common in philanthropy that we know very little about, which are funding scientific research and funding political advocacy. And so what I've been trying to do is basically just, as fast as I can, immerse myself in these two areas and get a good enough feel for what the critical questions are and what the key questions are that we can move forward with starting to investigate them. And it's kind of, you know, in some sense, it's a very broad assignment, but what I'm trying to do is just get a set of good questions that will lead to more productive investigations. So I'm going to quickly run through what I've done on those two fronts and where I see us going. Political advocacy is something I know we've gotten some pushback for saying that we're even interested in it. And I think one of the prevailing views of political advocacy out there among our fans, and it is the same as a view I held a couple of years ago, is that you don't want to get involved in political advocacy as kind of a rational altruist, because for any issue that you might get involved in, it's usually these issues that you see have a lot of really intelligent, really effective, really well-meaning people going against each other. And so why would you want to enter into that kind of, you know, tug of war, and what value add are you going to have? And how are you going to be sure that you're right? And, you know, actually, as from kind of what I've been doing over the last year is just reading whatever I can, talking to people who we're close to or close to that world, and kind of trying to understand the thinking here. And I actually have a very different picture of what good political philanthropy looks like, which is that a lot of politics comes down to what you might call represented concentrated interests versus unrepresented or diffuse interests. And so just a good way to visualize this is to think about something like the farm bill or farm subsidies, where you basically, you know, you have a powerful agricultural lobby that says, we want these subsidies. These subsidies are really, really important to us. And then you kind of have the rest of the country, which is kind of, you know, you could argue about whether these subsidies are really essential for Americans as a whole, and my impression is that they're not, and this is something we could look into more. But let's assume for the moment that they're not, and what you have is a lot of people who are affected in a very small way and who aren't organized in the same way as the farm lobby. And so that, I think, is like a good framework for thinking about these things, that in a lot of cases... Oh, and some of the people affected by subsidies as well are people overseas, are the poorest of the poor, who they don't have any lobbying. I mean, they're not agitating for anything in the U.S., in the U.S. policy world. And so one way to think about the role philanthropy can play in policy is you find an issue where kind of the side, there's one side that's kind of in the best interests of humanity, you might say, because our focus is humanitarian, but that side is not particularly well organized or not particularly concentrated, and you can come in to represent it, give it a stronger voice, provide that analysis, and provide the lobbying and provide the grassroots organization and make something happen. So that's kind of like, you know, a general framework that to a lot of people is just common sense, but I think also to some of our fans is not how they think of politics. And I think it actually is the right way to think of at least the parts that we would consider getting involved in. Another thing I think I've sort of picked up that has really influenced how I want to go about attacking this cause is that I actually believe it's conventional wisdom, and I believe it's true, that a lot of, as a philanthropist, a lot of what you can do in the policy world is build capacity for the unpredictable day when you get your opportunity. And so it might be tempting to look at today's political world and say, well, this is what's in the news today, this is what might change today, and then here are a bunch of things that people don't care about or that public opinion's against or they'll never pass because we've got this party in control. And I think that would be a bad way to choose issues. I think it's much more intelligent to look at, instead of looking at where an issue is today, look at where it is structurally. Look at who are the interest groups who are going to care about this thing for the next decade or two. And think about what the landscape looks like from that perspective, and realize that in politics, things can change very fast, and for reasons that are hard to see coming. And so, you know, I think actually a lot of the stuff going on today in the policy world is a good testament to this. I think immigration was considered a really, you know, an issue that wasn't going anywhere anytime soon, and then we had this Gang of Eight thing. The gun control thing, I think, you know, gained a lot of momentum from kind of a big media event. So you kind of don't know when these things are going to happen necessarily. And when you look at a lot of the big impacts philanthropy's had, I believe those impacts are there. I believe philanthropy has had an impact. I'm not sure about this. This is part of why we want to do more work on history of philanthropy. But I think it often follows that pattern. So with that framework in mind, I think the basic plan that I'm contemplating right now is to kind of, you know, go issue by issue. Because within a given political issue, it's pretty easy to find experts who know a lot about it and who know a lot about the players involved and the relevant relevant issues. And I think we have a list of issues that we think are pretty important from a humanitarian perspective. And the question is, how tractable are they? Who's lined up on each side? What are the relevant interest groups? And what's the value added of more philanthropy coming in? And so that's kind of the direction that I think we should be going, is you want to explore a lot, you want to basically talk to experts who specialize in a lot of different issues, say, who are the players, and look ideally for places where the side you want to help is not very well organized, doesn't have a lot of philanthropic presence, but it could, and where the side that you're going up against isn't completely insurmountable, or where there could be conceivably room to make something happen, but that's not the same as saying something's going to happen in the next year. It could be a much longer timeline than that. And I think this contrasts with the way a lot of people go about political advocacy, because the way that I've kind of seen things in what I've read about is that people will decide, this is the issue that matters to me, and the most important lever is policy. So now I'm involved in the policy fight, and maybe you're involved in an impossible policy fight. And I think what we're trying to do is kind of multiply the humanitarian importance by the tractability and by the marginal room for more philanthropy and see what we can get that way. So that's kind of the tentative plan we have. I still want to talk to a few more people before we go down the issue-by-issue path, but that's kind of where I see us likely going. And then on the science front, the scientific research front, this is something where we've made less progress. I mean, I've spent more time on politics. And I think with scientific research, I think a couple observations I've made. I mean, one, it's an area that is just really hard to get anywhere on without good scientific advisors. And certainly in any area of philanthropy at all, you want to work with subject matter experts. You want to consult with them. You want to have them explain things to you. You don't want to be, you know, trying to do all the work yourself from primary sources. You'll miss a lot of subtle things. But I think in scientific research, it's kind of a different level. I think it's very hard to even understand a claim or to even evaluate a single idea without having a lot of context that could take years to build up that you want your scientific advisors help with. So a lot of the question I'm asking is, who should be our scientific advisors? And how are we going to find them? Because we need people who are on board with the kind of broad humanitarian mission of GiveWell and who are also good scientists and who can also translate between those two worlds. You know, one preliminary feeling I have about biomedical research, which is where I'm focusing for the moment, it's huge. It's like half of all the public research funding in the U.S., which is, you know, a good chunk of the world research funding, goes to biomedical research. And my kind of intuition is that there's a lot of smart funders, there's a lot of people who basically have humanitarian goals, and if you find a blind spot of the existing funders and you find an area that, you know, really is better to invest in than it's structurally given credit for, you may be able to get the existing funders to go there. And so in some ways, my early intuition, which I'm not claiming I'm not going to reverse, is that, you know, a lot of what you want to be doing is diagnosing. It's kind of a meta-research type project. You want to be diagnosing the ways in which today's scientific community isn't finding all the best opportunities and kind of getting that information out there instead of necessarily just, you know, picking your field and funding the best stuff you can. I feel like the first one is probably more leveraged. And so, you know, somewhat consistent with that, I think an early idea we had for investigating scientific research was to do stuff like what we've done with meta-research, to work with people in the research community and say, have them interview their peers about the ways in which the current system, the NIH system and all that, is not funding the highest efficiency stuff, is not promoting the best humanitarian practices such as data sharing. You know, a close friend of mine who's been a GiveWell fan for a long time, Dario Amodei, has like kind of taken it on himself to do a project that's very similar to that description. He calls it Vannevar, has a website at vannevargroup.org. And so part of what we've been doing is just watching them, advising them, working informally with them, attending their meetings, and just watching what they come up with for, you know, here are the things that should be happening in science, but they're just kind of structurally not because of the way the various bureaucracies are set up. And there's lots of hypotheses there that I don't have time to get into, but that's kind of, you know, that's the two areas that I've been thinking about the most, and so I'm happy to take questions about those now. Yeah.
Yeah, just about this last point. I guess my initial reaction to that is that I would wonder if, you know, even if research and scientific funding was allocated perfectly efficiently under the current system, wouldn't we expect that the interests of the rich world would be vastly overrepresented in that field and the interests of the poor world vastly underrepresented? So even if we increase the efficiency of how it's done, the gains
right.
are still going to predominantly go to the developed world.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. A couple of caveats I would give to it are, one, you know, a lot of what is done in the public sector is basic research, where it's very hard to tell what the applications are actually going to be. And so a lot of it is just, you know, understanding how to understand the human body and how to measure it and how to, you know, intervene in it. And so there's a large degree to which, you know, what you want is kind of to advance our general understanding, and it's not all focused that way. Later stage research, I think, is more, I mean, there's some extent to which this applies to basic too, but I think later stage research is where this really comes in, where like you have some promising leads on a drug that affects rich people versus poor people. Well, the pharma companies will work on the one that affects rich people, and maybe no one will work on the one that affects poor people. I think that's a real dynamic. I think that is also like one of the very biggest things that the Gates Foundation is working on. And so my kind of feeling is, you know, I think this is an area that if you wanted to support it, you would more or less want to follow along with the Gates Foundation. And that's something that, to some extent, we've tried to do. I mean, we've talked to them about this a bunch. We've tried to get a feel for how promising that this is, what their returns have been, what they've gotten out of it. But, it's something where I think there is. I mean, the biggest player in philanthropy is very much interested in this and is making really large dollar bets on it. So that's something to keep in mind. Yep.
I'd like to hear a couple examples of areas in the political arena where you think that, even though you really haven't done research, where just as you're reading up, you thought maybe, oh, that is an area that, you know, maybe either historically or in the future, GiveWell could make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so areas in the political world where we've thought, you know, there's potential for us to enter and make a difference and that we might be interested in. And there's a bunch. I mean, I guess I'll put out three right now. I mean, I think two are kind of, you know, more simple. I mean, one is foreign aid. I think there is a presence, there is a lobby in favor of foreign aid, but I don't know that it's the strongest one that it could be, and I think it's possible that more dollars could make a really big difference. That's obviously kind of a contentious question, whether you want more government money going to foreign aid, and that's something that I think we'd have to analyze on the merits as well as on the political tractability before we actually got involved. But my intuition is that, you know, it would be a very good thing. There's funding for scientific research itself where I also perceive, I mean, I think there's groups that lobby for more funding for their cancer or their disease, but, you know, funding for scientific research as a whole, my impression is that that isn't the most powerful lobby pushing for that. And that's another area that I think potentially has really huge returns. Then a third area is one that Alexander's going to talk about, but that would be immigration reform, and I think I'll just let him handle that when we get to his slot.
One thing Holden mentioned offhandedly before is this project that we want to get more involved in with the history of philanthropy. And one of the things that we most want to do is be able to answer this question much better, which is if you look at the last 30 years, what are the, I don't know, the 20 cases where you can say, like not because there's a story, but because you really analyzed what happened as carefully as you could, that philanthropic funding made a difference. And what difference did it make, and how well did it go, and what does that say about philanthropy's future opportunities to improve the world through policy advocacy? And so like one of the reasons we're like moving forward on the front of sort of this understanding how policy works and thinking about where philanthropy fits in. And then we're also trying to say, if we look back historically, what has happened? What can you say about the success stories, also the failures of philanthropically funded policy change? And I think that those two things together will put us in a better position to know the types of things that we can accomplish. Yeah?
Your political advocacy example seems to be drawn from the U.S. federal government.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the question, I think this is a really good question. This is, you know, the political advocacy comments were based on the U.S. federal government. Have we thought about other countries and other levels? The answer is, like, I've thought about it a lot. We're trying to start with something that makes sense to start with. It's kind of trying to bite off something we can chew, and this probably sounds like more than we can chew anyway, although I think we will get somewhere on it. You know, this has been, I think, the easiest, most practical way for me to start thinking about policies that are highly leveraged, that are a really huge deal, that I still have the connections and the literature to start getting up to speed on relatively quickly. So I think I want to look at US for a while to just get a feel for what it looks like to evaluate policy. But actually, yeah, I mean, we've discussed this a lot, this idea that, you know, for example, if what you want is for more people to be able to immigrate to developed countries, it doesn't matter that much what country you do that advocacy in. You could also argue that other countries are kind of going to be a more important part of the future than they are now, and that if you could, you know, there may be more room to influence policy in those countries. So I think this is a huge deal. I think there's a lot to it. I think for the time being, I think it makes sense to investigate things the way we are, but to definitely have that looking at other countries and other levels of government on the agenda. Other levels of government are interesting because I think there's, you know, a lot less money and it's a lot less crowded if you start talking about, you know, a particular state's policy or a particular city's policy. Obviously, the implications are less leveraged as well, but I that's another area that I think is really interesting.
Oh, yeah, I'm back. Right.
Do you envision, like, being able to generate kind of a
bottom-up number? Right. So the question is, what do we envision our research on political advocacy looking like? What do we envision our recommendations looking like? Are we going to be able to quantify them the way that we've quantified bed nets with every X dollar saves a life? I think that we are... On one hand, I don't want to promise to start giving, you know, cost per life saved figures for everything we do, because I think a lot of times it's just not going to be doable in a way that has, like, narrow enough error bars to really be meaningful. But I do think that we're always going to have an eye toward cost effectiveness. And so an example of how I can imagine making the case for political advocacy is, like, this is how much, you know, we think it's going to cost to put together a really good effort. If that effort results in, like, this kind of change, then this is the humanitarian impact. And the humanitarian impact could be in terms of, you know, could be in terms of, for example, people who are able to immigrate to a developed country, and then separately we have an estimate of what that means for their income, right, and for their quality of life. And if, you know, several different cases, if we get this result, that's what it looks like. If we get that result, that's what it looks like. And you can kind of look at that and look at how much we're going to spend and then look at how likely we think it is to succeed, which is also going to be a very subjective call, but we're also going to lay out all the evidence we have. So that I think is actually pretty consistent with the approach we've always had, which is to say, you know, we're going to take all the relevant parameters, we're going to give you all the evidence we have for each of them. A lot of them are kind of guesswork and are kind of judgment calls, and even with our direct aid, I think that's become more and more the case, where it's very clear your opinion on deworming and bed nets, you know, has a lot to do with some judgment calls you're making and some values that you have. So I don't think we're trying to get rid of that. We're not trying to boil all that down to one number. We're trying to boil it down to many numbers to help people understand the case and help them make an informed decision about what they prefer.
Yeah, I mean, that said, like, this shift from just doing, you know, quantifiable direct aid to these new areas is a giant shift. And it's one that,
right.
You know, I think we probably were first talking about how we would make this shift a couple of years ago. And, you know, this is a big challenge for us, because when the type of work that the Against Malaria Foundation does, well, it's based on evidence, but they're also out in the field measuring, or they're getting data on malaria case rates, and if the bed nets don't get used, they're going to know because they're surveying the people. If people start getting, malaria cases don't fall, they're going to see that. And so ultimately, you know, our recommendations are being held accountable to data that comes in after the fact. And that, you know, that accountability mechanism is unique about the type of work that we do relative to the philanthropy that's come before. And now, like, what we're saying is there are these other areas we want to look into. That accountability mechanism doesn't exist in the same way. And, you know, we think we have to do this. It's the right call because those opportunities could be even better than bed nets. We have to look into it. At the same time, we're very cognizant of the fact that this is very different. It's very challenging. And I think as internally, we are worried about how we'll hold ourselves accountable to this. But I think it's also like we want you all to hold us accountable to not, you know, getting lazy and getting soft on how critical we are about these less quantifiable opportunities.
And that said, I think that going into the less quantifiable stuff is really good for proving the things that we really care about. Because at our core, GiveWell is not about quantifying and proving everything. GiveWell is more about transparency and openness and criticality, self-criticality of analysis. And so I think something we run into a lot these days is, you know, of course you guys can publish all the details of your analysis and have open conversations about it and hold yourselves accountable because you're doing the easiest stuff and it's the most quantifiable, it's the most measurable. And we just think that's not valid. I mean, we think that you can analyze anything. You can analyze, you know, things that are very hard to look at and that have a lot of judgment calls, and you can still do it in a way that's self-critical, that's open, that's empirical, that's looking for all the facts that are relevant instead of in the way that I see it being done now.
I was interested in obviously the search relationship with Good Ventures, and in particular, it would strike me as at least plausible or possible that the sort of activities you could do in terms of political advocacy might be very different if you're an individual donor compared to a $1 billion fund.
Yeah.
And if that were the case, kind of how would you break down your time and investment and focus on the sort of things that could be donated to by sort of individual donors versus the sort of things that maybe are only possible for $1 billion funds like conventions?
Yeah, so the question is, and this is a question that I think is an important one and that we've definitely struggled with, is there is sometimes there's a qualitative difference between what a big donor can do and what a smaller donor can do. If you have $1 billion, you can create a new institute, you can create a new field. If you have $1,000, you really can't. And I think when we started GiveWell, we were really looking for things that would scale with each like $1,000 or something. And that's really where we focused. And that's a lot of what led us to this direct delivery model. And that imposed a lot of limitations on us. And I think we have to get away from that. I think for the foreseeable future, the basic thinking is going to be to look at all the money moved that we project being possible. Money moved means money that people give to where we recommend it because we recommended it. And think about that as the pot of money that's available. And, you know, let's say that with $5 million, you could do something really great, but with $1,000, you couldn't do anything. Well, that's still possible for lots of $1,000 donors to pool their donations. And so that's still going to be the pitch, is like, this is how much can be done with this much, and we may set up mechanisms, we're not sure, that, you know, that allow people to participate in that way without having to, you know, let go of their money if it doesn't work out, if it doesn't add up to the right number. So that's something I think for the foreseeable future, we're mostly looking for things that make sense with the overall pot that we project, and we'll find a way to let individuals in on that, with the caveat that one of the reasons we continue to maintain our traditional work is because that's the stuff that scales with $1,000. And so I think, like, really, if you want something that scales with $1,000, that's going to be your best bet for quite some time. And as long as we maintain that, I don't think people are going to be stuck with the pooling model, but it'll be open to them.
Yep, Tom.
So I want to just make the point. I'm a board member, and this may be obvious, but I think that reasons for getting interested in political advocacy are both obvious, and I think the risks are obvious as well. I think there's potentially a significant perception issue by GiveWell's audience or potential audience in stereotyping or sort of generalizing GiveWell's activity as being, you know, representative of a particular political viewpoint or a particular interest group.
And I think it's something that we need to be vigilant about. I think our process in general, what Holden and Ellie were talking about before concerning transparency and critical thought and openness are really important, especially in the context of this area of inquiry. And I think it's really important that people like the people in this room call us out on things that are potentially, you know, charged one way or another. Because I think, you know, it's very easy to say, you know, if you're going to criticize, for example, you know, agricultural aid, there may be a lot of people who are in favor of agricultural aid that might not be willing to listen to Givewell's message because of their political viewpoint. So I think that there's the risk of that happening in a lot of different ways, and I think we need to be, as board members and as management and employees of Givewell, just sort of aware of that. That being said, I think given the opportunity, given the amount of dollars that are involved in political aid, it would be kind of a major oversight to not engage in. I think given the work, given the track record that the organization has, I think there is potentially good work to be done. But I just sort of wanted to get out in the open that this is something that it's not lost on us. It's a significant risk. And if you guys want to address that, that's fine. But one other thing I wanted to actually ask you about was, if you're beginning to see a lot of political flaws in the system are sort of kind of a piece with each other, namely, you've got concentrated, well-organized interests going up against diffuse, less organized interests, why wouldn't you focus on the process element of political advocacy as opposed to specific causes?
So the question is, if you see, you know, systematic issues in the political process, why not focus on fixing the process rather than just on going after the issues? And the answer is, I think that question basically comes subject to the same set of questions that any other political issue does. So, you know, there's people who say that the issue that tops all the other issues is money in politics, and we need to get that one right. And my response would be, okay, what are the possible policy changes that are somewhat realistic? What would the likely impact of those changes be? And how organized are the various sides? And are we going to hit insurmountable opposition? And is the forces that we would support, are they already organized? So I think all those same questions apply. I mean, frankly, I'm giving you a lot of intuitions that I have now that I'm not in any way saying these are what I've determined or what I know or what I'm going to stick to. But, you know, at this point, I would say that battle is maybe tougher to a degree that I don't think it's unreasonable to go after the issues instead of the process. And, you know, this is a pretty consistent thing at Givewell, is that, you know, we don't really have a view on root causes versus symptoms. Sometimes one is better to go after, sometimes the other is better to go after.
Yeah, and one interesting thing we've reflected on in the last few months as we've been working on the newer areas is, you know, what we have with our current top charities is the result of 5 years of consistent work developing the process and evolving from something that was very, you know, much less well-formed, obviously, in 2007, 2008 when we started. And so I think the stage we're at now with this politics stuff is somewhere like where we were in the middle of 2008. You know, it's like we don't really know what we're going to find yet, and we're just at the stage of sharing our intuitions, our basic process, and getting feedback. And I think that, you know, a year from now we'll be somewhere better, and 2 years from now we'll be somewhere better. I do think it's worth just pausing the questions, and so Alexander can talk a little bit more concretely about some of the specific things we've been looking into.
So I've been working on some of the same stuff that Holden's been working on, but from a little bit of a different perspective, and sort of trying to figure out, as we are doing this sort of like really, really big picture investigation of like how do politics and how do research look and work, what are some actual like issue areas that we could focus on, and how do we do research in those areas in an effective way when we're sort of time constrained? You know, like there's 50 or 100 causes that we think might be sort of promising, and you want to look at those and go through all of them, and that's a time-consuming process. And so I've been trying to execute on a few of those so that we can kind of figure out how does this research process work, what do you learn, what are the best questions to ask. The three sort of big questions that we're approaching these with are the questions Holden already mentioned, but it's like, how big is the problem, how bad is it, you know, what can you actually do, how tractable is it, And who else is already working on it? Does it already have a lot of money relative to some standard for how bad the problem is? And in particular, the issue that I've been working on sort of the most in this field is what we call meta research, which is sort of how can you improve the efficacy of biomedical research to deliver more humanitarian value. You know, one of the things that gets some news sometimes, but is I still think really shocking, is how low the reproducibility rates for bio studies are, and it varies across all kinds, from like lab research to epidemiological research, so like all the nutrition studies that you would read, to even randomized control trials, which are actually much better, but still have surprisingly low replication rates. And so we have this problem where like the studies that are published in medical literature aren't necessarily true. And that both wastes effort as, you know, people try and build on that research and it doesn't work, and then also, you know, leads to actually bad clinical outcomes. We got interested in this because of our own practices as users of research, where like we were trying to find what does the evidence say about bed nets or these other interventions, and all too often there was just not enough information out there to really make good decisions, and there are too many biases in the literature. And so in particular, we sort of followed the work of the Cochrane collaboration, who we've mentioned a few times here before. They do these sort of systematic literature reviews and meta-analyses of trials to figure out how effective different kinds of medical treatments are. And last year we made them as a $100,000 quick grant. That's on our blog. You can read about more about it if you're interested. So what I've been doing for the last couple months is talking to a bunch of different people in this field. I've talked to like 25 or so, and just tried to get a sense of what are people doing and what are the problems that they face and how do they think about what this is as a field. So that we can try and get a sense of what are the actual giving opportunities you would have if you decided to enter this field, what kinds of returns might you expect, and who's already in it? Are you competing with other funders for giving opportunities? You know, I think it looks promising, but we're still sort of at an early stage, and it's the only one that we've done in this depth yet. And so the main thing we see when we look at this is, like, it looks promising, it looks like it's a big problem, and that not too many other people are working on it yet, but that there's a community of people who would love to work on it if they could get money. But that said, we just don't have a sense of how it would stack up against other particular giving opportunities that we might find in other areas. And so we don't feel at all like we're ready to sort of pull the trigger on it, you know, sort of really far from that, actually. And so the, you know, I think we're going to continue to sort of pursue that as like an interest, as a sort of a like, you know, low boil. And there's some conferences that we'll go to that are related to it where you can get sort of a high amplitude of exposure to people in a low, sort of a low research investment. But I think we're going to continue to try and do this kind of research on other areas so that we get up to this baseline so we can make better comparisons to move forward with in the longer run. So that's the one we call it medium depth. It's like not, you know, it's not years of work, but it's been like a couple months of work that we've put into that so far, really sort of just trying to get up to speed in the field and what it looks like. The next stage down is, I don't know, I might call it like medium shallow or something, for two causes that I think we've heard people refer to as sort of colloquial over the years that we've run GiveWell, as things that might be considered sort of like the biggest problems or the biggest issues in the world. And so not surprisingly, climate change is on this list, and the other one Holden mentioned is immigration, where I think there's some economists think that it's like really the biggest problem, and that if you could get this, everything else would sort of fall with it. And so, you know, we've done different levels of research in these two different areas. A lot of our work on climate change focused on reading and summarizing the impacts from the IPCC's 2007 report, to try and answer the question like, how bad is this if it happens? And then also, you know, one of the things we'd still like to do, but I think before we sort of move forward with climate change, is to do more to answer the question, like, really, what could you do? Like, you know, looking at the track record of philanthropic spending in climate change, trying to figure out, like, if you entered this field, what would be a good estimate of your sort of the tractability or likelihood of making a difference? On immigration, oh, and on climate change, we also did some sort of basic work on how much money already goes into it. I think it's sort of, I don't know, it's in between, it's hard to say. It's probably like several hundred million dollars a year of philanthropic funding in the U.S. go to climate change.
We published this, right?
No. It's a few days away. Okay. So that'll go up soon. And then the immigration we also haven't published, but had sort of done less work than climate change, but more than the other things I'll mention in a second, that are sort of super shallow. And, you know, this is something we had sort of like five conversations with various different kinds of experts. Holden laid out like the basic texture of this case already. What you see is that, like, you know, there's a potential group of people who benefit a lot, potential migrants. Their interests are extremely diffuse and unorganized. Then the people who, it's like not a problem that's considered especially tractable. It's really unpopular throughout the developed world. And so it's not clear how these things would stack up. And we haven't done, actually, I think there's like a couple questions you'd want to ask about like how good is it actually, and we haven't really asked them yet, and so I don't think like this is something like we're far from kind of trying to make a bet on it or anything, but it is really one of the few issues where you see economists sort of in so much agreement, and in so much agreement that's a big deal. And then the two other things that we've actually sort of done like the shallowest level of and actually published that you can find on our site already, they were places where we just wanted to start because we already knew something about them. We're just sort of ready to write it up to get the practice of doing these kinds of investigations. One was the risk due to asteroids striking Earth. A few weeks ago, there was a day where an asteroid hit Russia, and then there was another flyby. And so, you know, that was sort of in the news, and it was just a fun sort of short investigation to do. I don't think it's going to be our main focus area going forward, but you never know. We'll see how other things stack up. And then the other one that's like a pretty interesting one is domestic migration seasonally within the developing world. You might hear a lot about urbanization in the developing world, but seasonal migration is actually pretty common in a lot of places. There's this one super interesting randomized control trial that found that giving people basically like insurance that if they didn't get a job where they migrated, they'd get their bus fare paid for, really, really increased the rates of migration, and people actually did get jobs and made pretty significant financial returns from getting that sort of the insurance against loss. And these are people who were living on, you know, like less than a dollar a day in Bangladesh. And so it was an interesting group where like it seems like you get a high financial return from sort of enabling people to go in search of jobs in an urban area during the seasonal famine. And so, you know, we just basically like wrote up the study and said, it's interesting, here's a few more questions if you want to prioritize this going forward. Learned a little bit about the context by talking to the guy who ran the study. So like that's really the level of investigation that we're doing for something that's like really shallow. That's kind of what we did for asteroids and domestic migration. And for other things, it ranges up to like, I don't know, 20 or 30 conversations so far. I think, you know, in the long run, we want to really go deep on something, and that would mean like talking to hundreds of people.
So those last two are both public on the website, domestic migration and asteroids. If you're wondering how to follow like when these things come out, there's a couple different ways, but you can sign up for emails where you get alerted every single time they come out. There's an RSS feed and you for Twitter, and you can stay up to date on all the new stuff that gets published as it gets published. So like when climate change comes out, the water thing I mentioned comes out, that'll all go through there.
We haven't blogged this stuff yet because we still sort of feel like it's the first ones we've done. We're not totally confident whether this is the method we're going to use going forward. And so we didn't want to sort of max out transparency. I think we will publish on climate change. We'll publish a blog post about it within a short amount of time after we publish it, because it's interesting.
We did put up the pages, just not blog. Just a matter of how we highlight them. One more just like note about like the underlying context here is I think one of the things that's evolved in our approach over the last year maybe is, you know, just coming to see the cause as the most important unit of analysis. So, you know, but the kind of picture that I have now is like you want to pick the best causes, and then it's going to take a really long time and a good deal of commitment to like find the giving opportunities and to be able to assess them. And I think that's not necessarily how we were always approaching things, but that's now kind of the framework we're in. I think it's probably the right framework.
And I mean, one of the things that we've learned as we've done these investigations is that it's actually sort of surprisingly easy to find people giving you specific giving opportunities once you express an interest in a field. Like sometimes people say like, oh yeah, I've been wanting to find something for this for like years, but I didn't think any funders were interested, and they'll sort of see something. Or other times, you know, like they're just like, oh yeah, I got like six proposals rejected in the past 5 years. You want to see them? So we actually thought like finding or sourcing giving opportunities was going to be hard. That's been surprisingly easy, but we don't feel at all like in a position to judge between these giving opportunities because they require all this sort of context-dependent knowledge about what the field looks like and what would be successful.
All right, so let's open it up to questions. It can be on anything, whether the stuff Alexander said or Holden or you know, traditional GiveWell, like no holds barred.
My question is, how are you? I'm wondering if you can say more about how you're picking causes for different levels of investigation right now. And how are you deciding which of these to go into? If you can say more about that. More than what you've already said on the website.
Definitely. I mean, so
repeat the question.
Oh yeah. So the question was, how do we pick causes for different levels of investigation? It's a good question. I mean, so the way I put it is like meta research is something that we had sort of a theory-driven approach to it. Like it was something we were interested in. We didn't see any funders working on it at sort of like the like really quick level investigation. And it's something where we felt like we actually had a sort of like value added as a funder potentially because it's like a need we had felt. And so that was sort of what got us initially interested in that. And you know, we continued to do the sort of like, you know, 20 conversation level because we continued to sort of learn interesting stuff and to keep going there. Climate change and immigration, you know, I sort of said, like, these are issues that people point to. Like, a lot of sort of really smart public intellectual types are saying, like, these are the biggest issues, so that's what drove our attention there. Asteroids and domestic migration are, you know, two of 100 things on a list that we have, and they are not the, it's not a well-prioritized list, but they are particularly tractable, easy ones to start with. And part of the reason we chose them is because it's a little harder to know if you're going to do, like, you know, we sort of call them, like, 10 or 20-hour investigations, where they're, like, you read a couple papers, you talk to a couple of the experts in the field, you write it up. It's pretty hard to know, like, how to do that for some giant field that has a huge literature and has been, you know, billions of dollars have been spent on it recently. Like, at least think about, you know, roads in the developing world. Like, that's actually much harder in some ways than things that have, like, one paper and one study where you can talk to the guy who did the study. And so we're still sort of getting started and trying to figure out, like, how will this methodology scale to much bigger issues?
Sorry, what in the developing world? What was that word?
Roads. Sorry.
Right, so there's this giant challenge, right? When we started GiveWell and we're like, we're just going to look for things that are proven and cost effective, you know, that very quickly narrows the world sufficiently where there's only so many things that you have to look at. And when you say, well, now I want to be open to many things, it's a big challenge to figure out how to prioritize, what to look at. If you rely too heavily, obviously, on initial intuitions about something, you can go very wrong. And so one of the main things that I think we're struggling with is how do we develop the right process to come up with good results a year from now in the investigations we've done. And I mean, I think one of the main things we have to do is very obvious, which is increase the capacity with which we can do the 20-hour level of investigation to have something more than that initial intuition about how good something is. And the 20 hours filter into the 3 month, and the 3 month filter into the 2 year, and hopefully, like, that's our leading hypothesis of, like, how we'll go about doing this work. But we're severely understaffed to do that type of work relative, you know, really quickly right now.
I mean, on the bright side, I mean, I would describe what we've done since the beginning is we always look into stuff for some combination of it being important and it being, like, easy to look into. And sometimes we get criticized for this, and sometimes we get confusion for this, that, you know, people start to think, well, GiveWell's all about stuff that's proven. Well, we looked at proven stuff because it was easy to look into. But in the process, we gain information about how to run the process in general. So a lot of what we're doing right now, it's not that we picked these. We didn't pick asteroids first because we thought it was, like, the best issue. But we picked it because we thought we'd be able to look into it and learn something about how to look into stuff in general. And I actually think we're making quite a bit of traction on that. I think there was a time when we were kind of trying things and they just weren't generating interesting information and just nothing came of it and we had to bump into a few walls. Now I think we have a process that, like, you know, it produces these write-ups. These write-ups are somewhat informative. They help us think about what to do next. I think we're moving toward having focused causes. And a lot of the problem now becomes capacity. But, you know, now we can look for people who can do this work. We know what the work is that we're looking for people to do. So that's kind of the methodology here.
So with regards to political advocacy, you mentioned, and I was about to hear this, tractability is a very important variable.
Right.
Sounds like you're also aware that the level of confidence you have in that variable is much lower than you've been dealing with. What does a tractability estimate for political advocacy look like?
Right.
Do you have a vision for how you're going to, like, describe the answer to that question?
Yeah.
Get into it?
Yeah, so the question is, what does it look like to estimate the tractability of a political issue? I think the answer is basically that it's comparative. So we want to look at a lot of issues and say, okay, this is, like, one of the most tractable issues and also one of the most important. So within politics, you know, that is one of the best ones to work on. Now if you're trying to actually estimate a probability that you're going to have an impact, I mean, this becomes very fraught because, again, we could be talking about a 10-year time horizon, a longer time horizon. The kind of impact you have is very unpredictable. You don't know exactly what you're going to get. And that's something I'm not sure exactly what we're going to do yet. I mean, I wouldn't even rule out that we would just say, you know, if you think this basic political advocacy approach is good, here's what we think the best issues are. And, like, that's all we have to say. I mean, like, you know, we may not be able to give the best guidance on that versus other causes. I'm optimistic that we will be able to do more than that. That we'll, like I said, be able to do the case analysis. Well, if, you know, if you think we have this much of a chance of getting this size change, then here's how that shakes out as compared to something else. Actually, weirdly, I think an even harder, much harder area to do return on investment analysis for is scientific research. I think that one is really, you can start talking about the progress we made on heart disease and cancer and the progress we hopefully will make, but a lot of the highest returns to biomedical research are stuff that's just like really hard to even describe before it happens. Or, you know, especially because the lag between discovery and actual application can be like decades. So that's going to be a tough one. But, you know, I think the basic approach is just get all the facts we can, do all the analysis that we think is like grounded enough to have some meaning. And there may be points at which we say, look, you have to decide, like, on this parameter, like, we can only give so much guidance. We can give our intuition, and we can give what it means to have other intuitions.
Yeah, also just know, I mean, this is something that people study. You know, there's, like, people who focus on different political issues and what role different factors played in their in a particular policy going the way that the people wanted, whether it's money or how big a deal it is in the media or whether the White House got involved or whatever. I mean, this is a field of study. And so, we're not like venturing out on our own in terms of whether this question has been asked before. Yeah, Jess.
So, I mean, I was a big fan of that idea about looking at the history of philanthropy and the cases where people have successes and failures. For political advocacy, do you guys have like a historical case in mind? Because, I mean, like the gun debate one, right, where it's this,
right.
Everybody been working for years on this, there's this huge issue, they put a bunch of resources into it, and nothing, it ended up dying, right?
Right.
So is there one there that was successful that you guys think about?
So the question is, are there successful political advocacy cases that we have in mind? We're collecting a list of these cases. We're going to vet them at some point. I actually think there's a lot of successes. I think, you know, the environmentalist movement, I think, has had a lot of impact, and I think philanthropy has played a role in it. One example that I'll give of just, like, I think it's just a good example of how to think about political advocacy in today's environment is something that I got from an essay by Stephen Tellis. That's contrasting financial reform with healthcare. So with healthcare, that both of these are things where there was a big moment in the last, like, you know, 5 years or so, a big kind of somewhat unexpected moment. And so with financial reform, what happened was there was this giant financial crisis, and everyone was interested in financial reform, but there just wasn't a lot there in the way of groups that had concrete proposals that had been vested, that had been vetted, that had been carefully developed. There weren't like highly developed financial reform lobbies. They were really tiny compared to the banks. And it kind of, you know, it didn't, well, I guess according to the person writing this, it was a very unsatisfying outcome. And again, this is more me describing a hypothesis than something that I've looked into. And then a good contrast is healthcare reform where, you know, there was Atlantic Philanthropies put something like $100 million into this cause, building up this organization, Healthcare for America Now, and I think some other organizations. There was a failed attempt, a big failed attempt, but even failed attempts can sort of, you know, help to build the capacity of organizations and help to figure out what's not going to work next time, what is going to work. And, you know, healthcare reform had a big moment, and there were a lot of policies and a lot of ideas ready to go, and there were a lot of coalitions that had already been put together. And so, you know, this hypothesis is that both these things had this big unexpected moment, but there was much bigger progress on one that was directly traceable to the work that it had put in building capacity over the previous many years. Want to emphasize, these are not, you know, this is an example that I think is helpful to think about what the hypothesis looks like. These aren't cases where I necessarily, like, agree with the claims about what policy should have been or anything like that, or that I agree with the claims about how it went down.
Yeah, I mean, one of our kind of first priorities for this History of Philanthropy project is putting together that list of cases to vet. You know, not because you wouldn't even know until you put the time into vetting them, like, what were the drivers. So hopefully we'll have that, and that should be happening, but, you know, that still just nascent project.
So I guess, I mean, your aim is really to inspire people to understand how much money you can give, and I think especially when you're looking at things like global health, people are very often looking to kind of donate a few dollars here or there, so if you look to give up something like that makes a lot of sense. But when you're moving into something like political advocacy, or especially maybe younger people would be interested in getting involved in ways that are not necessarily purely financial, so for a lot of people lobby or call or, you know, even through social media, people are involved in these things in ways that aren't just purely by
right.
An effect, but also a sense, you know, if you have this many people call your congressman about this, it might have a chance of doing this.
Right. Yeah, the question is whether we're, once we get into stuff like political advocacy, whether we're going to be making recommendations about things other than money, like, you know, what petitions to get involved in or what calls to make. You know, I think our mission is pretty focused on how to give well. I mean, that's our name. And so I think that's where we're going to be. I think that our research might be interesting to people who are interested in other things. I think, especially now that we have more of a cause orientation, identifying the best causes, you know, you could certainly imagine some implications for what, you know, what you want to get involved in as a volunteer or as an employee, but we're going to let others mostly draw those conclusions. I think that, you know, we're going to focus on the dollars.
In the back.
Yeah, speaking of which, have you thought much, maybe the answer is yes, about how to get people to give more? And I think in this case, more is definitely better, but, you know, the website and you know, you guys are full of information, but, you know, zero market, right?
I wouldn't say zero.
Well, not zero.
One. Yeah. One.
So, I mean, it seems to be a little bit, like, I'm just curious. You know, you talk about better research in asteroids. And so.
Yeah. So it's a good question. I mean, so this question, yeah, this question is, you know, we've talked solely about research. You go to the website, it is obvious that we prioritize research over marketing. Well, what about marketing? You know, one of GiveWell's key goals, the way that one of the key inputs into how we assess ourselves is how much money goes to our top charities as a result of our research. And so there's this, you know, outreach is a key component of whether we're successful at what we're trying to do. You know, what we have done historically is taken only the outreach or marketing opportunities that seem to be the most likely to have high return on investment. You know, and so that means we've done some marketing. I mean, we've been in the media. We use Google AdWords to spread the word. We, you know, we hold events when we can to try and get the word out to a greater extent. But we're certainly, like, heavily prioritizing research over marketing. And there's really, like, a few big reasons for it. One is, like, even though we have a big vision for what GiveWell eventually will be, and we're not there yet, we're very happy with the growth we've had thus far. You know, we've roughly doubled every year that we've been in existence with our money moved. So if you, like, look at that impact page, our money moved is growing. The other fact is that research itself has always been our best approach to marketing. I mentioned this earlier in our board meeting, but, you know, just Peter Singer, the philosopher at Princeton, who talks all about giving, has been by far our best marketer. And the only reason he's our marketer is because our research is really great, not because our marketing was great. You know, he looked at our stuff and said, this is great. This is different than anything else out there. And then he spreads the word. And then the final thing that I'll add on that is, I think for the, you know, right now for the organization, if, you know, 2 years from now we had this meeting again and we could only share the same level of information about politics or research or whatever cause, you know, I think that would be, like, frankly, a disaster for GiveWell as an organization.
Even if it was a lot slicker, the way we presented it.
But it just wouldn't be good. Like, that's not acceptable. But if our, like, money moved sort of slows for a couple of years, like, that's by no means the end of the... Like, we wouldn't like it. We love the growth. That's important. But we could deal with it. And I think, like, longer term, we need to have that research in place where when someone says, you know, how do you estimate tractability of research, or how do you estimate cost effectiveness of scientific research, or how did you pick these random three causes out of 100 to look into, that we have a really good answer to give them that's not just, hey, we got started on this other area 3 months ago. Because, like, if I were a donor thinking about the best place to give my money, I mean, I'm not satisfied personally with that answer. I wouldn't be satisfied with that answer. And so that, you know, that's why we feel like we have to prioritize the research.
So that's good. That's not quite what I was getting at. Have you looked into research about how to give? I mean, if you're focusing on research and then
right.
Have you looked into how to get people to give more?
So the question is...
Not necessarily right. To you, but, you know.
Right.
The question is, have we looked into research into how to get people to give more? So I think what you're thinking about is, like, a general intervention to raise charitable giving. Not so much like us marketing ourselves. So we haven't, I mean, I don't know that the research has, I think basically there's an industry that is, like, pretty interested in this, that I think just thinks about it a lot better and does it a lot better than we do. I think in a lot of ways, you know, it's just not our comparative advantage. It's not something that we're very good at thinking about. So it's not something that we've really focused on. You know, I think it's possible that it should be a shallow on the list of many causes for shallow investigation. Like, does this research or do organizations like this have high returns? But you know, I think it's not something that stood out to us as something that would be a really logical place for us to go.
I think
Madeline,
quote me for talking because I don't really know your organization very well, but just listening to you talk, you and those criticisms of the scientific research that you looked at because of the biases that limited their findings, and I just my concern hearing you talk is that there is bias in the way that you're going about finding your causes, and
right.
As you build more and more on that initial catchment of what to look into, as you become more and more powerful to influence giving, it could really start pushing things in directions. I mean, they all seem like extremely worthy causes, but I feel like maybe a little more curiosity looking inward into where are we getting our ideas, who are we getting them from, maybe these political figures, these big important smart people have things that are pushing them to value certain types of charities
right.
over each other, and when you present them on the website, it just says top charities, it doesn't say top charities based on the fact that we started in these areas, you know what I'm saying? I don't want to criticize, it seems like you're doing great work, but I think as you get bigger, the potential for the biases to direct you off in the wrong direction is greater too.
Right, so the comment raised is a concern about potential bias in, where we're getting our information, how we choose our causes. Obviously, there's a lot of subjectivity in giving. I think one of the things that actually sets GiveWell apart from other charity evaluators is that we don't pretend otherwise. Our actual goal is to really put our biases out there and let people examine them and let people discuss them. And in general, I think we do that more than anyone else. And so I think a lot of people want, quantitative formulas for what charities are the best, and you divide their, their expenses by their overhead, or that's not exactly what you do, but, I think that's something that actually I think sets us apart a lot, and I think we write a great deal about our worldview, our values, where we're getting our ideas. Certainly don't want anyone to have the impression that, because a lot of smart people think immigration is important, therefore we've decided it is. But it is something that gets it onto our radar screen, and we're totally upfront about that, and we're upfront about the other things that get onto our radar screen. So I don't think we're aiming for no bias. I don't think that's really possible in philanthropy, but I think we're doing more than anyone else to put our biases out there and to make them part of an open discussion, and I think that's a lot of the core of what we're trying to do.
I would just add that in whatever it is that we end up producing, it will be very clear like what we did and didn't do to get there. So like, this list of 100 things, I who knows how many we'll actually get through before we ever make a recommendation. But certainly like the list of things we looked at and then how we decided to move forward, and I think we'll have a hard time saying like how we got to the things on the list, because it is like a lot of heuristics and biases that we have and share. But we've tried to be really expansive about that list, and we'll make it public.
Right. So like we're all going to answer this one. Like if you go on the website right now, you can see a recent blog post Holden wrote about the values underlying our research. These are not facts that are true. They're the values that a lot of us share that guide the things that we look into. Also if you look back at the research that we have completed that is public, you see not only the things we recommend, but all of the steps we took to find them and everything that we considered, but either decided not to recommend or even decided not to spend time on. We want to put that all out there because we are with you that this is a big problem, this fact that we're making judgments that are leading to the recommendations that we have, and we want to put people like you who care enough to think about it and share your thoughts to know what's happened so you can both weigh whether it fits what you're looking for, but also criticize us if you think we're doing something wrong. That's why we're doing this. That's what we appreciate.
There's one more piece of that I wanted to get to. Sorry. Well, we didn't address the top charities thing, and I just want to say that our top charities, I think top charities is exactly the right word. They're the charities that we personally give to. I honestly believe that the best giving opportunities I know of today are the top charities on our website. So I just think that's accurate. And it's top charities from certain people with certain opinions, but I think that's how they're perceived.
All right, we're going to take one more question and then we'll wrap up. Tim.
No.
Fine.
I have opportunity to answer questions. That's awesome.
Okay. Oh.
Tim gives his spot up.
Tim yields.
You should auction it.
Okay. Shoot.
Actually,
two questions?
Pick, you have to rank them. And
do you want to pick or do you want us to pick? Pick the good one.
Well, the second one might be on the website, so that might just be a quick answer. My first is, in terms of meta research, I can certainly see why that, why the things you mentioned are a problem, but it's harder for me to imagine what an intervention that an individual donor could fund would look like. I wonder if you have any ideas in mind. The second question with regards to migration is, have you considered the effects of brain drain that, that can happen? And maybe that's already on the website, but coming up soon.
So on the first question was about meta research, and it was like, what could an individual donor actually fund? I think it's a pretty good question. I think one of the things that actually, interestingly, like, makes this field most promising from our perspective is that there's not a lot of organizations that are sitting around waiting for you to donate to them. Like, it's a pretty young, immature field, and so it's not clear that, like, they're just people who are already doing something and just waiting for more money. A lot of the people who are talking about it are academics who work on grants, and so it's sort of the thing Holden mentioned earlier about, like, you know, if we ended up like really focusing in this field, we would figure out a way to pool money from individual donors to be able to make grants in some sort of smart way, I think. You know, we're really far from this, and so we don't know exactly what that would look like, but I think that would be the plan for how it would work. The, how much do you want to know about like what an intervention might be?
Well, I mean, if you are interested, I mean, we'll publish what interventions are, but Alexander mentioned he had these 20 conversations or so with experts. They're all on the conversations page of our website. And in every conversation, we ask, like, what is a giving opportunity here? And people will explain the project that they're supporting.
And we'll eventually be doing a summary, too, so you don't have to read all of them. But you can.
And then on the second question, which was about brain drain, like, no, we haven't looked into it too much. It's definitely on the agenda. I think it's one of the, for, from a humanitarian perspective, probably the main thing people point to as an objection.
All right, well, we're going to wrap up. Holden, Alexander, and I are going to stick around as long as folks want to stick around and just chat informally. We really appreciate you all coming out to this, to the, I don't know, anti-charity gala or something.
you know, that, in both senses, right?
It's charity anti-gala.
You know, we know that this is not the, like, normal, conventional, cool way to do charity, but we really appreciate people who are interested in enough in our work to ask questions, to criticize us, to engage intellectually with it, because that's really what we need to be successful. So thank you all for coming.
And grab some pizza.